So let us continue where we left off yesterday. We were looking at the Chanki Sutta, and today we can start the next sutta, which is from the Anguttara Nikaya 10, number 61. This sutta is called Avijja, and is here translated as ignorance. So this is another sutta which is really about, if you like, a summary of the path. It looks at the whole path from the beginning to the end in a fairly short space of time. So it's like a summary sutta which looks at an overview of what we're supposed to be doing on this path. And these summary teachings are often very useful and remind us of the big picture of what we're supposed to be doing. And then we'll get into the more details later on, hopefully today, and see how things go from there. Now the first thing about this sutta, it is translated as ignorance. The Pali word is avijja. And the Pali word avijja, really what it really means is a lack of insight, a lack of understanding of things according to reality. So ignorance may not be the best kind of translation. When we think about someone who is ignorant, we think of somebody who doesn't know very much about something. But this is not really about knowledge as such. It is about the deep realization and seeing things according to reality. And for that reason, I think ignorance is not ideal. I think something like delusion is probably a better translation. It gives us a better idea of what this really is from a Buddhist point of view. It's a misunderstanding of reality. It's thinking that the world is one way when actually the world is a different way. It's thinking that we are one way when actually we are a different way. It's all about the deep insight into the teachings. So the opposite of avijja in Pali is vijja. And of course, vijja is often described in the suttas as knowledge of the past lives, knowledge of the laws of karma, and then finally the final awakening experience, the destruction of the asavas, of these corruptions of the mind, if you like. And all of that is, again, about seeing things according to reality. And for that reason, I think a good translation of vijja is insight. So you have insight on the one hand, and the opposite of insight is delusion. One is understanding, one is seeing things according to reality, the other one is a misunderstanding. Insight versus delusion. Very often the word vipassana is translated as insight. But I personally prefer to translate vipassana as clear seeing. That is my preferred translation. Because insight is a specific moment when something happens, when you see things clearly. Whereas vipassana is this very broad thing that you develop throughout the path from the very beginning to the very end. So this is the delusion sutta. And the idea is to make us less deluded, right? Not to make us more deluded. The sutta about delusion. So this is how it goes. Because this is said, a first point of ignorance, because is not seen such that before this there was no ignorance and afterwards it came into being. Still, ignorance is seen to have a specific condition. Yeah, so this is a very interesting little phrase at the very beginning there. And it is a phrase that you see in many places in the suttas in slightly different wording. And other cases you often see things like, samsara has no first point, right? Before a certain point it came into being and afterwards it did not. So samsara, or here, delusion, and all of these things are very related to each other according to the suttas. There's no beginning of this thing we call avijja and delusion, is what this is saying here. This is very interesting because the vast majority of religions or philosophy or even science, they will say that there is a first point. Things begin at a certain point and after that things kind of carry on. If you know almost all religions in the world, they have like a mythology or a legend about how the world originated. Right? In Christianity, the world was created in 7 days by God. In Hinduism, they have all this kind of mythological theological ideas about how the world came into being. First it was nothing, then Brahma said the word Om or something like that, and then somehow it was created by these kind of things. And if you look at world religions, one of the main functions of religion very often is to create a sense of beginning point, where things started out from. Because people feel a bit kind of... It's kind of difficult, right? We want to know things. We want to be certain about things. We want to know how the things, how the world works. Because if we think that we know how the world works, we kind of have something we can lean on, something we can rely on. We kind of feel that we have more control over things when we understand things in that way. And it's not just religion. If you look at modern science, it's a very similar kind of idea that the world began with the Big Bang, right? Before the Big Bang. Nothing. Then after the Big Bang, then kind of the world came into being. But it's a bit like a miracle, right? How does something come out of nothing? And this is what some of the physicists have said. They have said, give me one free miracle and I will explain everything else to you. Right? This is what kind of science is like. One free miracle, the world comes into being from nothing, and then from there I can kind of explain everything based on the laws of physics and all these kind of things. So it's almost like religion, right? And this is where Buddhism is so different, because, and it's almost unique, I think, in world history and in world philosophy and in religions and in everything else, in that there is no beginning. We don't say that there is a first point. When you go back in time, you go to past lives and you go further and further back, you can never actually find the point where everything began. There's always something prior to that. Things always going on beforehand. Here they call it ignorance. Ignorance, there's no first point. Right? We have always been ignorant, or we have always been deluded to some extent. It doesn't start anywhere. Samsara, the same thing. We have always experienced things, always going backwards. And to me, that is a very realistic way of looking at the world. Because why would there be a first point? It seems completely illogical why suddenly something should have come out of nothing. Okay, God created the universe, but what about God? Where does God come from? Right? Same kind of problem, right? So you're not really explaining anything by saying that God created the universe. You're just creating some other entity, which is just as complicated as the universe, and putting that beforehand. But the Buddhist idea is that there's always another cause. There's just things being impermanent, things moving on backwards and backwards and backwards in time. And there is no starting point to this. It's to me, a very plausible and reasonable way. But perhaps a bit unnerving, right? There's no beginning. We don't really feel we have any control over that. It seems a bit dangerous almost. But what is also interesting about this is that the Buddha here, he doesn't say that there is no beginning. What he says is that no beginning can be seen, right? This is another very interesting thing, because from a pragmatic point of view and a practical point of view, when you look into the past, you can only go so far. You can't keep on going forever. That's just impossible. Because if something has no beginning, you can go to a certain point, and at a certain point you kind of have to give up, right? Okay, I can't find anything here. So the point here, and this is one of those things about the Buddha's teachings, it's a very pragmatic teaching. It's a teaching based on your personal experience. It is not a teaching that actually lays down theories or ideas about existence. It's about what we actually can see for ourselves. It's empirical, if you like. The idea of empirical science is that you observe the universe and then you draw conclusions from what you observe, but you try not to make any philosophical statements beyond what is observable. And this is what the Buddha is doing. He's observing the universe, and then he's saying, well, from what I have observed, there is no beginning. But he doesn't lay down any theory or speculation beyond that. And that's why he says, no beginning, no first point can be discovered or can be seen. So again, very interesting that Buddhism is all about discovery, about seeing things according to reality. And in this, of course, it shares many things in common with the ideals of science. It shares in common this idea that we want to discover things, we want to see things. It's not just a matter of belief and a matter of trust in things. So this is very, to me, very kind of reassuring and a very nice way of thinking about existence. And a very nice way of thinking about the way the Buddha talks about the universe, without theory, but all through direct experience. And this is one of the reasons why I think sometimes the word religion is misplaced for Buddhism, because it is about insight, it's about real understanding. It is not about taking things on board in terms of faith or that sort of thing. Faith has is a factor in the Buddhist teachings, but it's not the final factor. The final factor is always seeing things according to reality. So this empirical aspect of Buddhism, I think, is a very interesting one and a very important one that makes it quite special in many ways. Ignorance has no first point, right? And one of the things that means is that ignorance is this kind of what you might call a self-perpetuating force. When there is ignorance, that ignorance creates more, or that delusion creates more delusion in the future. It drives itself, right? It doesn't need anything else apart from delusion to drive itself into the future. If you are deluded, you create more delusion, and on it goes. Unless somehow you are able to gain some insight and understand what that delusion is about. And that, of course, is where the Buddha comes in and seeing things according to reality comes in. But essentially, because you are not aware that you are deluded, because you don't understand that, right? If somebody comes to us and if nobody tells us that maybe there is no self, maybe there is no permanent aspect to us, it is very hard for us to see through that, because it feels like, here I am, right? I feel real. Don't tell me I'm not real, that's terrible. You know. So it needs somebody from the outside to shake us up a little bit, to be able to see things in the right way. Otherwise, that delusion keeps on recreating itself, potentially for eternally, unless there is some kind of disruption in that. So this is the problem with this delusion, right? This kind of that it has this self-perpetuating ability, driving us on and on and on, and never really stopping. So this is part of the problem here. No first point of ignorance can be seen. But then the Buddha says, and this of course here is interesting. It says that still, despite this, ignorance is seen to have a specific condition. And this, of course, is very important, because if ignorance or delusion or avidya, if there was nothing that conditioned it, if it was kind of absolutely solid, there would be no way of getting rid of it. It's the very fact that it is conditioned that enables us to do something about this. This is a very important point, that it is conditioned. Right, so we try to remove those conditions that support it, and by removing that, of course, then there is some possibility that we can get rid of delusion and we can see things according to reality. So this is what this sutta is about. It's about how to get rid of the conditions that support delusion. So this is really exciting, right? It's really exciting stuff. I find it really exciting anyway, because here we can find out how we can see things according to reality, how we can become wise. Wisdom is the opposite of delusion. And to me, wisdom is this beautiful word, right? It's kind of one of the best words in all of religion or philosophy, the idea to be wise. Because when you are wise, you understand where happiness is, where suffering is, how to live well in such a way that it actually gives rise to all these good things in life. That's what wisdom is about. A wise person is somebody you go to ask questions, because they can give you a penetrating answer, right, about how to live and how to do things right. Wisdom is like the highest faculty. And you see that in Buddhism too. You see the five spiritual faculties. The highest one is the Panya Indriya, the faculty of wisdom. It supports everything else. Once you have the Panya, once you have the wisdom, everything else kind of comes as a consequence. So here we are, undermining delusion. That's what I mean by this is so exciting, because here we find out how we can actually achieve this highest wisdom. So ignorance has a specific condition. Now let's see what that condition is and see what we can do about that. So this is the summary of the, again, of the whole path coming out here. So having said that, he says, I say, bhikkhus, that ignorance has a nutriment. It is not without nutriment. And what is the nutriment of ignorance? it should be said the five hindrances. Yeah, so this is the first one here, is the nutriment for ignorance. What does nutriment mean? And nutriment is like food, exactly. It's like, you know, you have the food that we eat for breakfast downstairs, that's kind of nutriment. And there are many different kind of nutriments that support us as human beings, but one of those is certainly physical food. So here, nutriment is that which, first of all, it keeps you going, right? Without food, you won't keep going very long. And two, it also keeps things growing. Nutriment, if you give nutriment to a plant or a tree, it grows. If you give nutriment to a child, it grows. If you give too much nutriment to someone who's an adult, they grow this way, right? So there's always growth coming from nutriment. So nutriment is that which keeps things going and makes it grow. And these two things are both important aspects of the idea of nutriment. And what that means in this case, if we say that the five hindrances are the nutriment for avidya, it does two things. It keeps avidya going, right? As long as you have these five hindrances there, it will support avidya, support delusion, and keep it going. And we know that's true. I would recommend you to reflect on this, because when the mind has defilements in it, you know, if you are wise about it, if you reflect carefully and you observe what is going on, you will see that there is a degree of delusion there. Right? If you have strong desires for something, you feel this compulsion to run after it. And then afterwards you think, wait a minute, why did I run after that? It was a crazy thing to do. And then you do immoral things as a consequence of these powerful desires inside of us. Or you're angry about something. You do something silly because you're angry, and afterwards you understand that was a silly thing to do. So when you are under the control, under the power, under the mastery, if you like, of these powerful hindrances, you know that you are deluded if you are smart about it. When you come out of those hindrances afterwards and you think, whoa, that was really silly. And you know that this was delusion at work right there. So observe these things. When you observe these things, it becomes far more powerful than just seeing these things through reflecting on the suttas. But see them in your own life. See them in your own mind and heart, and they become very clear what is going on with these kind of things. So we are deluded. And what it means is that the more you reduce these five hindrances, the more clarity you have. And think about it, right? Sometimes you sit there, you do some meditation practice, and you feel quite peaceful, right? There's no real desire or anger or ill will, no real restlessness in your mind. You just feel really nice and peaceful. What does that state feel like? It feels like a degree of clarity, right? Sometimes when you sit back and you really rest and you feel clear, sometimes the answers to difficult questions, they just come to you. Why do they come to you? Because the mind has clarity. The mind has the ability to penetrate difficulties when the mind is clear like that. The more you notice these things, the more obvious it becomes where the problems are and where the solutions lie. Why a reduction in defilements and hindrances is such a powerful way of seeing things more clearly. So vipassana goes up, hindrances go down, right? You see things more clearly. That's why I call translate vipassana as seeing things clearly. There's increase in vipassana. Also, hindrances go down, samatha goes up. You feel more calm and peaceful. Samatha and vipassana, this pair that always goes together in the suttas. It's a compound, samatha vipassana, they call it, because they increase together. They're not separate things as such. Two sides of a knife, said the famous simile by Ajahn Chah, right? The samatha and vipassana. So, the less hindrances we have, the more clarity we have. And that's why we are moving towards less delusion, removing the support for delusion. And ultimately, when we take away the hindrances completely, there is no nutriment there anymore. Right? The nutriment for delusion has been abandoned. So it's like a plant. If you have a plant and you give it no nutriment, it may stand for a while, right? Because it kind of has some nutriments still perhaps in the body. It may kind of stand for a while, but it won't take long before it starts to fade away, and eventually the plant will die because it doesn't get any nutriment. Same for human beings, right? Eventually, don't get any food after a few days. You start to, you know, eventually you die. Same kind of thing, yeah. So, and the same thing with delusion. If we keep those hindrances away for a long period of time, eventually delusion starts to die because you start to see things according to reality. The only problem there can be a wrong view. If you start off with a very strong wrong view, it can take a while for that delusion really to penetrate, and you're still holding on to certain things. But even then, I think gradually it will move away, and that's why the Buddha is able to make finally the breakthrough to seeing things according to reality. So these hindrances, they give the nutriment, they make both delusion grow and they support it. And what that means is that making delusion grow means that the stronger the hindrances are, the more deluded you are, right? So remember that. Sometimes if you can't see it clearly for yourself, it is useful just to remember that. So when you have very strong desires, you are very angry, you feel very restless or very confused, you know, you should be aware that now I am deluded. Now I really can't see things clearly here. And just by remembering that, it makes you a bit cautious, right? If I'm deluded, okay, maybe now is not the best time to make an important decision in my life. Maybe now I shouldn't make any decisions at all, because right now I don't know what I'm doing. So just that memory, that realization that these hindrances cause delusion in the mind makes you step back a little bit and say, okay, now best not to, you know, to even to say anything to too many people, because what's going to come out my mouth is very uncertain at this particular time, right? You know what it's like, I'm sure. Sometimes it is kind of unreliable, these kind of things. And it makes you more cautious, more careful in how you act, in how you think, in the decisions that you make. Good time to make a decision is when you feel peaceful, you feel relaxed, you feel clarity, you can see that the hindrances are weak, right? That's always a good time to make a decision, because the natural intuition inside of us of what is right will tend to come out at that particular time. So hindrances support and grows these delusion. So our job then on the path is to reduce these hindrances, right? Reduce as much as we possibly can. And as we do that, we find that we become wiser and less deluded people. Okay. So then, of course, the next question is, well, these five hindrances, how do we deal with them? And this is the beautiful thing about the sutta like this, because it takes us back stage by stage, right? One factor by one factor. And the next question is, what is it that is the nutriment for these five hindrances? And the answer is the three kinds of misconduct. This is the nutriment for the five hindrances. And the three kinds of misconduct are, of course, misconduct by body, speech, and mind. This is the misconduct that is meant by this. What that means is that whenever we misconduct ourselves, if we do things that are immoral or not virtuous or not kind, we are actually increasing the five hindrances. Right? And what that means in turn, of course, is that just by living well, by keeping the five precepts, or by speaking kindly to other people, just by doing that much, the five hindrances are already decreasing. These things are the nutriment that cause the five hindrances to grow. And by doing the opposite, we are reducing the five hindrances. It's quite nice, right? So if all you have to do is just to be kind, and these hindrances will gradually decline as a consequence. Of course, an important factor here is the third kind of misconduct, which is the misconduct of the mind. So to really be able to overcome this kind of misconduct, we have to deal with the mind directly and actually sort out our mind. And one of the things that I will look at later on in this retreat is how precisely to deal with the mind so we can overcome some of the defilements of the mind. I think this is a very important aspect of the Buddhist path. It is not just about keeping the five precepts and doing meditation practice, but it's actually how to effectively overcome the problems, the mental problems that we have, the anger, the desires, these kind of things. How can we overcome these things in an effective way? And one of the interesting things that the Buddha has to say about this is that the way to overcome these defilements is by reflecting in the right way. It's how we reflect, how we perceive, how we look at the world around us. This is one of the ways of dealing with these problems. So it's so important to reflect in the right way and to think about things in the right way. If we do that, then these defilements would actually decrease as a consequence. So that is the three kinds of misconduct for you. Okay, I'm going to have a 30-second coffee break, so please, please bear with me. Once you get given all this nice coffee, you really have to drink it, right? Otherwise, it's terrible. So, okay, if I start talking too fast, it's because of the coffee, so just please remind me not to talk too fast. Okay, so that is the three nutriments. Three kinds of misconduct being the nutriment for the five hindrances. And then, of course, we need to go back further. What is the nutriment for the three kinds of misconduct? You almost don't need to know that because we know what good conduct is, so all we have to do is really keep good conduct. But still, it is very interesting to know what the nutriment behind this is. And the answer is that the nutriment for the three kinds of misconduct is lack of restraint of the sense faculties. Right? Lack of restraint. So what does this mean, this idea of restraint of the sense tank? This is one of those very important aspects of the Buddhist teachings. If we don't have restraint of the sense faculties, it means that when we go out into the world, when we meet people and we see things, we always are either attracted or averse to the things that are around us. We like somebody or we don't like somebody, right? We see something that we desire or we see something that is unpleasant. And we always have all these reactions to the world around us. And this is the way we are kind of manipulated. That's what advertisement is all about, right? An advertisement kind of draws you in one way or another way, and you are kind of the puppet in the hand of the advertising masters. The advertising industry, they read all these psychology books, right? How to kind of manipulate people to the max. This is what advertising is all about. So don't think that you're not going to be manipulated. You are. Everyone is going to be manipulated. This is part of the problem. So the way to avoid that is to practice the Buddhist path, right? Sense restraint. When the idea of sense restraint is to reduce this feeling of being manipulated by the world around us. So instead of always being attracted to things or being averse to the things around us, especially to people, but to everything else in life as well, we try to get this even mind in life, the mind which goes through life without all the ups and downs, but is as even as possible. And when the mind is even, when it isn't really jumping around, being desiring that, being averse to that, then there is a degree of mindfulness there, and that degree of mindfulness enables us further to react to the world in the right way. When there is no mindfulness, that is when all of these things are even more powerful, drawing us this way, drawing us that way. When we have that evenness to begin with, it means we have the ability to kind of to withstand some of the attractions and aversions that the world kind of gives rise to inside of us. So this is sense restraint, right? Gaining more evenness of the mind. And I'm sure you may have notice that. I certainly notice that in my own life. The big changes over after being a monk for 22 years, and how before I was much more drawn by the ups and downs of the world, and how now at least I'm a little bit more even, right? I make no claim to be absolutely even, but a little bit more even. Before it was like this, now it's just like that, right? That is already a good thing. It means a little bit of mindfulness is creeping in there slowly over time. Sometimes it's going too slowly, it wants to go faster, but you can only do what you can do. And it's very beautiful when you see that, because you feel that you are more in charge of yourself. Right? You feel that now you can actually react to the external phenomena in the way that you like, instead of always being influenced by those external phenomena. And you just reacting automatically, you're now reacting from what is Dhamma rather than from all of these kind of defiled states of mind instead. So very useful, right, to have this sense of sense restraint. Now, what does it actually mean? How do we do sense restraint? And this is one of those very important things, and another thing I'm going to talk about much more later on in this retreat. But one of the ways of doing this, people often think that restraint means force, because the word restraint in English means like you're holding somebody back, you're restraining them, right? You're not going to go there like a small child, okay, don't go into the traffic because that's dangerous. So you hold them back a little bit, right? Otherwise they might die. So in that case, restraint is good, but or even force, a little bit of force is good. But when it comes to the mind and overcoming defilements, that is the wrong way of going about it. And I will show you that this is quite clear from the suttas. So the word like restraint has to be used with caution. If we use it the wrong way and think about it in the wrong way, we're going to go do this whole practice also in the wrong way. The way the Buddha talks about restraint, it should come about through wisdom, through understanding, through reflecting in the right way. And when we reflect in the right way, it's almost as if the sense restraint happens automatically all by itself. You just think rightly, and when you think rightly, the mind just doesn't go there, because the mind understands that this is dangerous territory. Right? It's so natural and so easy when you use wisdom. When you use wisdom, there's no sense of force, no sense of becoming tired, because you're applying the mind so much. And also, the wisdom power is much more powerful than willpower. When you use wisdom power, the defilements tend to disappear like that. Using willpower, you suppress them for a while, you let go of the pressure, bang, they kind of spring up back at you again, right? It doesn't really work all that well. So this is, I'm not going to talk much more about that now, because this is a very important topic. I'll get back to that later on. That gives you some idea of the idea of sense restraint on the Buddhist path. So now, what is the nutriment for sense restraint? And I better put on my glasses, otherwise I can't see very much. So, and the nutriment for sense restraint, it says here, is lack of mindfulness and clear comprehension. What is the nutriment for non-restraint of the sense faculty? It should be said, lack of mindfulness and clear comprehension. Yeah, so this is the nutriment, what makes sense restraint stronger. And this is, of course, the reason why that is the case, is because to be able to restrain your senses, you have to have mindfulness, you have to be clear about what is going on. This is like the guard which tells you you're heading in the wrong direction. Right? You can see if I keep on looking at this person I don't like much longer, ill will is going to rise in me, right? I'm going to feel a kind of sense of aversion. I'm going to get upset because I find them difficult or whatever. Or if I look at this Ferrari a little bit longer, desire for Ferrari is going to arise in me here. I don't know. I'm just making things up, right? It may be silly, but it's just... the idea is that you are aware of what is happening in your mind. And the clear comprehension comes in there. The clear comprehension, remember, is about understanding the purpose and the suitability of what you're doing. So the way I'm looking at this person, the way I'm looking at this car, is it going to enhance my spiritual practice? Or is it going to detract? Does it fill the purpose that I'm trying to achieve in life? Is it suitable for what I'm trying to achieve, right? This is clear comprehension or full awareness. You know how this fits in with the path as such. So that is why this then becomes part of sense restraint. Because if you have that mindfulness, the ability to see what is happening, and you know whether something is going to lead in the right direction or not, then you have a chance to decide how you should restrain the senses and what is appropriate and what is not. Only through that are you able to see these things. And what is the nutriment for lack of mindfulness and clear comprehension? It should be said, careless attention. This is ayoniso manasikara. Right? And the previous one was sati sampajanya. It's all these famous words, right, that you see in the suttas everywhere, and they're all here, all part of this. Ayoniso manasikara, careless attention, sometimes translated as unwise attention. You are looking at the world, attending upon the world in the wrong way. Yeah? And this is another of one of those very important terms in the Buddhist teachings, the idea of yoniso manasikara on the one hand, wise attention, unwise attention on the other hand, two very important terms that you see everywhere almost in the suttas. And even to begin the Buddhist path from the very beginning, you have to have some degree of yoniso manasikara, right? When the Buddhist teaching, you hear it, some people, they hear Buddhism and think, ah, rubbish, don't want to be a Buddhist, that's really bad teaching, don't want to do that, I'd rather do something silly instead, right? That's, but they don't think that, but that's kind of sometimes what happens. So even at the very beginning, you have to have some degree of wise attention to be able to start out on the Buddhist path, to understand that there's something valuable here, something to be done, something to be practiced. So, and yoniso manasikara is something that goes with you all the way along the path, all the way from the very beginning, all the way till the point you become an arahat. Every time you have some insight, the insight arises because of yoniso manasikara. You're attending to things in the right way. That has to come with you all the way along the path. And this is part of what this is showing you here. So what does it actually mean, wise attention? Right, it's easy to think, yeah, I know what wise attention is, right? You feel, you go one way, you feel more wise, you go another way, you feel more unwise. It kind of feels, yeah, I have some idea what it means. It's easy to think that and to delude ourselves. But it's important to be very precise about these things. Because if you are very precise about what these things mean, it is more easy to know whether you really have a wise attention or whether you are just kind of fooling yourself a little bit. So you have maybe a little bit idea, but one of the way that this is defined in the suttas is that you have yoniso manasikara, you have wise attention whenever the mind is moving in the right direction on the path. Whenever the defilements are going down, whenever you see more clearly, whenever you have a more kind heart, whenever you feel a bit more peaceful, whenever you have a bit more compassion, whenever you have any of these kind of qualities that go in the right way, at that point you have yoniso manasikara. If you have ayoniso manasikara, unwise attention, the qualities decline, right? So if I'm looking at that coffee now, right, I can think, oh, desire, more coffee here, right? And then that's called ayoniso manasikara, because it leads to desire. Before I know it, I will be holding the cup in my hand and drinking away here. So now, or I can think, okay, coffee is useful. I will drink a little bit just to kind of, be, you know, to speak sufficiently, not too fast, not too slow, just the right kind of speech, and to be able to have a little bit of extra wakefulness if I feel tired or whatever. Then I'm kind of thinking wisely about it, and my mind is not really too disturbed by the coffee. Not that coffee is going to disturb you that much anyway. This is just an example. There are things in the world that are far, far more disturbing than coffee, in particular relationships and that kind of stuff. Oh, can be very, very disturbing, both in a negative sense and the positive sense. But this is just to give you the idea. So if I reflect on the coffee in the right way, it doesn't give rise to desire, then is yoniso manasikara. Whenever the mind is heading in the right direction, it's yoniso manasikara. Whenever it goes in the wrong direction, ayoniso manasikara. Right? So you can actually know in a sense. So again, a very useful way of knowing what is the what these things are, yeah? So you can almost tell inside of yourself whether you are doing one or the other. Yeah? So, of course, what then is the nutriment for yoniso or ayoniso manasikara? And the interesting thing is that the nutriment for that is a lack of faith. Right? Lack of faith is a nutriment for ayoniso manasikara. And it is kind of, sometimes kind of strange. What does, if we're talking about wisdom, what does wisdom have to do with faith? And this is what I was saying the other day, that faith and wisdom in Buddhism are very closely related to each other. If you are wise, you also have strong faith, or confidence is perhaps a better word. And if you have strong confidence, usually it means that you also have a sense of wisdom there as well. If it is the real kind of Buddhist confidence that comes from a proper understanding of the Dhamma. Right, and the problem, of course, is that when we start out on the Buddhist path, we don't really understand what's going on. We don't understand what we are supposed to attend to. We don't understand, you know, what the defilements are even. We don't understand that desire necessarily is bad. Often desire in the world today is kind of said to be good, right? Oh yeah, we desire things, great, and then we enjoy that and that kind of stuff. And so the problem is that when we start out, we don't know what we are doing. So the Buddha, first of all, needs to explain to us what are the things in the world that are dangerous. What is it? What does it mean to attend to things in the right way? What does it mean to attend to things in the wrong way? How does this all kind of fit together? At the beginning, we have no idea what's going on, and that is precisely why we have the Buddha's teachings. After a while, as you practice, this becomes more and more your own understanding as well. So it's no longer just faith or confidence in the Buddha's teachings, but it becomes your own internal wisdom. So then the faith and the wisdom kind of growing together, and it goes more into the wisdom area, and it's not so much just pure faith anymore. It becomes more part of who you are. So it grows up. So this wise reflection, starting from faith and eventually becoming more an aspect of your own understanding over time. Yeah, so faith leads to an appreciation of the Buddha's teachings, leads to this wise attention. We start to look at things in the right way here. So where does faith come from? Right, and faith comes from hearing the true Dhamma. Saddhamma savanang is the Pali word for this. Is that right? Have I got it right? Okay, let's just check it up. Yeah. So it comes from hearing the good Dhamma. Saddhamma savanang. Right, so you have to hear good Dhamma here. It means a real Dhamma. Dhamma in Pali can mean any kind of spiritual teaching, but here it means the spiritual teaching that is related to reality as it actually is. And of course, that's what we claim the Buddhist teaching is. At least the early Buddhist teachings, they are relating us to reality. So when you hear the true Dhamma, you think, whoa, wow, this is so good. Oh, why didn't I hear this before? And we probably have, but we've forgotten in the meantime, right? And now we need to hear it again and again. That's one of the problems in life. So, when you hear that, you feel a sense of familiarity about these things. And that's what I think happens to so many people. I think that's exactly what happened to me as well, I think. When I heard the Dhamma, I thought, whoa, this is really good stuff. And I think it's just the fact that I probably heard the Dhamma already in a previous life. And then in this life, the kind of the faith comes back again as a consequence of that. And why do we hear? What is the nutriment for hearing the good Dhamma? And the nutriment for the good Dhamma is to hang out with the Saparisa. Saparisa Sangsevo, which means that means the association with the superior people. Is that what it says here? The good people it has here. But I would a better translation, I think, is superior people, because these are the people who are the Aryas, the people who have actually penetrated and understood the teachings. Right? So that is where it all comes from. And again, this is what I have been saying already a few occasions on this retreat. The idea that all ultimately it comes down to hearing the word of the Buddha, hearing the real teachings, right? And that comes from hanging around the Saparisa, the superior people. And of course, these superior people, these are the highest kind of Kalyanamitta. You know that other famous sutta where the Buddha says to Ananda, it's not 50% of the holy life, Kalyanamitta is 100% of the holy life, right? And this is exactly what we're seeing here. It is the foundation stone upon which everything else happens. If you have the right Kalyanamitta, if you hang out with the Aryas, the superior people, everything else will happen as a matter of course. You have no choice. You're going to be awakened, right? Whoa. It's a good deal, right? If you hang around with the Buddha, you know, and what does it mean to hang out with the Buddha? Hang out with the Buddha means to read the suttas and to take it on board. Hanging out with inspiring people around you, the people we think who are Aryas, things just gradually penetrate inside of you, and then this whole process of awakening happens as a consequence. Yeah, so this is the very foundation stone, the very basis upon which everything else is based. So the idea of Kalyanamitta, this is why the Buddha says it is 100%. Right? Without it, you're not going to go anywhere. And with it, if you keep on doing it again and again and again, things will just happen as a consequence. Now so the next thing here is a nice simile. I will read this simile out to you as well, because it's actually very nice and it draws, kind of makes this thing very clear what is going on. But before that, we have the whole sequence again in reverse order. And it's worthwhile reading it in reverse order as well, or in forward order, whatever you want to call it. And then it kind of reinforces the ideas here. So thus, not associating with superior people, that becoming full, it fills up not hearing the good Dhamma. Right? This is another interesting idea, this idea of becoming full. Right? It's filling something up. If we do good things again and again, we do the right things again and again, it's like we're filling that thing up. We're making it strong and powerful by doing it again and again. So if you hang out with if you don't associate with good people, right? If you keep on doing that again and again, all the time, always associating with maybe even bad people, right? Scallywags and gangsters and mafia people and triads and this kind of thing. I mean, that's getting really bad, but even just ordinary worldly people, all they think about is worldly things. If you keep on doing that, then of course you're going to hear all this other kind of stuff. You're not going to hear anything about Dhamma. You're not going to hear anything about spiritual qualities or values. You're going to hear all the thing about the worldly things and even bad things. That is going to become full. And be careful. Sometimes people think, yeah, I'm strong, I can withstand these things, I know what I'm doing, right? But remember, the point here is that this is what this is all about, is that our strength depends on our conditioning. And our conditioning depends on what kind of influences we have around us. So if you keep on being influenced by the wrong kind of people, you're going to be worn down. Right? Gradually, you will move away from these things because the influence is wrong, the conditioning is wrong. And you may not even be able to see it. It happens very gradually. And suddenly, one day, right, you are a member of this gang, right? Doing really, no, I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think that's really going far. But maybe a few lives down the line, right? Because gradually, you're moving in the wrong direction. So the idea here is kind of scary. When this becomes full, actually, you are becoming full of these qualities because you are conditioned in this way. This is the whole idea of non-self in Buddhism, right? If there is no self, if there is no permanent stability inside of you that can withstand all the conditioning, it means you are 100% the product of the conditioning around you. So as one conditioning wears off, another one kicks in, you are going to change. Yeah, and you have no choice about it. You cannot withstand these things. You're filling up the association with the wrong kind of people. And when you do that, you're filling up the hearing of the wrong Dhamma. And because of that, things are heading in the wrong way here. Kind of scary, right? So make sure that you're hanging out with the right people. Otherwise, oh, serious problems. And of course, all it does, it leads to suffering and problems down the line. That's really where it's all heading here. So not hearing the good Dhamma, the Sadhamma Savanang, not hearing that, becoming full, it leads to filling up the lack of faith. Right? Gradually you lose your faith in the Buddhist teachings. You think, yeah, Buddhism is fine, but you know, there are more important things in life. So not really making any progress on the path, so let's make progress in material things instead. That kind of stuff, right? It's so easy to be sidetracked. It's so easy to think in a different way. And very, very hard sometimes to keep your mind on those things that are really important. And then when that lack of faith is filling up, then what becomes full is careless attention. The unwise attention becomes full. That's pretty scary. Unwise attention becoming full. Ooh, that's not very nice. So you're really becoming unwise at this point, doing all the things that give rise to desires, to anger, to confusion, to delusion, and all of this kind of stuff. And when that careless attention becomes full, it fills up lack of mindfulness and clear awareness or clear comprehension. Less and less mindfulness, less and less idea what you do, more and more being pulled around by all the worldly phenomena leading you in the wrong direction. That's why lack of mindfulness and clear comprehension becoming full, it fills up the non-restraint of the sense faculties. Your mind is all over the place, now desiring this, now having aversion towards that. When that becomes full, the three kinds of good or misconduct becomes full. Whoa, three kinds of misconduct becoming full, right? That's not very nice. Imagine you're actually doing more and more bad stuff as a consequence, and you can't really hold yourself back because your mind now is really out of control. And that is what it is saying here. Then when the three kinds of misconduct become full, the five hindrances become full. Well, you're packed with five hindrances. Your mind is absolutely, they are just everywhere. And when the five hindrances become full, delusion itself, ignorance itself, avidya becomes full because of that. So you become more and more deluded, less and less idea what's happening. You can see how this is a really bad cycle, really bad cycle. And of course, if delusion becomes full, you can imagine what that means. It means that you're no longer so interested in the Buddha's teaching. You don't really want to hang out with the superior people anymore because you have less and less insight, you have less and less clarity. And this thing kind of rolls on and rolls on, negative thing influencing other negative things, and before you know it, you are in a completely different direction, with no interest in spiritual matters anywhere, heading off somewhere else in this world. And if you look at the world, that is what is happening to the vast majority of people, right? In modern world, where kind of material phenomena are so important to so many people, basically it comes down to the sense of delusion. And sometimes you have to shake people up a little bit and say, listen, can't you see that there's a problem here? And then for a short moment they think, oh yeah, maybe you have a point. And then they forget it again, and they keep on consuming and doing kind of all the other kind of stuff. And this is what happens here. All of these things becoming full because you are heading in the wrong direction. Okay, then next we have this nice, very beautiful simile that comes next. But I'm going to take a break now because I want to start with that simile afresh on the next session because it's a very nice simile. So let's take a break and let's meet back here again at 11:15. Ooh.